About a question that has been a kind of an annoyance and a problem in generalized Kähler geometry since it was introduced in 1984 by Gates, Hull, and Rochek. And generalized Kähler geometry was introduced, was discovered in searching for the conditions for n equals 2 comma 2 supersymmetry. So the question is, if you have a two-dimensional sigma model with values in a Riemannian manifold, what geometry does that Riemannian manifold have to have in order so that this model has 2 comma 2 supersymmetry? One very well-known solution is that the manifold be Kähler. But what Gates, Hull, and Rochek discovered at that time was that there's a more general solution, which consists of, so we have a Riemannian metric, we have a complex structure which is compatible with the metric but which is not Kähler. This has a corresponding non-degenerate two-form omega, and this is not closed. Not only this, but there are two complex structures. Rochek likes to call it a schizophrenic Kähler manifold because there's somehow the left and right moving modes on the string see two different complex structures and for their supersymmetry generators. So, so in addition to these two Hermitian structures, we also have, you could phrase it as a three-form, which is the Nevers-Schwarz three-form flux. And the condition here is that dc of omega minus is equal to dc of omega plus is equal to h, and dh is equal to zero. So this is generalized Kähler geometry as they described it at that time.
What does DC mean?
DC means I del minus del bar. It is the other real operator besides D that you have on a complex manifold. Okay, it's another way of encoding del and del bar, and that's why there's a subscript. It's because it depends on the complex structure that you want to use. Okay, so faced with this system of equations, the main problem and the problem which which continues to this day is that it's very difficult to understand the degrees of freedom in this geometry. What do I mean by that? So in the Kähler case, let me just say it in words. So in the Kähler case, we understand the degrees of freedom in the following way. We say that there's a complex structure, so we have the moduli of complex structures. Now, once you fix the complex structure, you can vary the metric by adding ddc of a function, dd bar of a function. So that means that there's a scalar degree of freedom in addition to the complex manifold degree of freedom. That's basically describing Kähler geometry, and that is what, you know, that extreme simplification that the metric depends only on a scalar parameter, a real scalar, that's what leads to, for example, you know, Yau's solution to the Calabi conjecture, because he expresses the entire. You could think of it this way: that instead of trying to solve for the Ricci flat condition, you solve in terms of a single scalar function, and you end up with this complex Monge-Ampère equation. So all of that whole idea. The same question exists here: what are the degrees of freedom? Right away, we're faced with the fact that we have two complex structures, and then how do we express the metric? And these are not closed, so you cannot simply, these may be 1-1 forms, but they're not closed. And so you can't say that they're dd bar of a function locally. None of that is available in this case. Generalized geometry led to several advances in the subject. So, and I'm only going to focus on some of them. So, so there are some underlying geometric structures, okay. Which. So we're going to look into this geometry and try to identify some underlying geometric structures which will themselves have parameters, and that will give us some clues as to the degrees of freedom inherent in this geometry. So first of all, the first kind of major simplification is that we can repackage in the following way. We can This is the usual formula that many people have seen. Let's say, I can make this matrix, put the dual down here. Okay, and this is an operator on the tangent plus the cotangent bundle. And let me just call these JA and JB, depending on whether we use plus or minus in the sign. And if we take these operators and repackage them in this way, then what we get is a pair of complex structures on this bundle. Okay, and the important thing is that they commute. Okay, and this is what we call a generalized Kähler structure. And the other interesting thing is that this bundle is equipped with a natural bracket, the Courant bracket, and the involutivity of these operators boils down to precisely this system of equations. So there is a simplification, a repackaging of the geometric structure into a pair of generalized complex structures. This is not the, I'm not going to focus so much on this approach, but it is kind of the important first step in analyzing this this geometric structure. Okay. Another underlying geometric structure besides these two generalized complex structures is that these complex manifold structures, they're not only are they complex manifolds, but they're also complex Poisson manifolds. So this was an observation of Hitchin, that if we take the commutator of these two complex structures, then what we get is the imaginary part of a holomorphic Poisson structure. And there are two of them. There's the one for I plus and the one for I minus. Okay. Notice that the failure of the two complex structures to commute is measured by this tensor. And this tensor has a holomorphic interpretation with respect to I plus, and similarly for I minus. So the significance of this for the problem that we're faced with is that when we do the same thing when we want to try to do something analogous to Kähler geometry and identify the holomorphic degree of freedom first, the holomorphic degree of freedom should include this holomorphic Poisson structure. Okay. So there's also, it turns out that this holomorphic Poisson structure comes to us in addition, with additional structures. In fact, there are holomorphic Courant algebraoids and Dirac structures. So there's a whole collection of holomorphic gadgets which come out of these equations, and which imply the existence of this holomorphic Poisson structure, but I'm not going to talk about that today. I'm going to restrict my attention to cases where these structures are basically equivalent to this holomorphic Poisson structure. Okay. So what we're going to look at is a special case, which I'm going to call symplectic type. Symplectic type means that the sum of the two complex structures is invertible. Okay. And what it means is that, if I got this correct, forgive me, but I'm just going to switch the, just because I want the A model to correspond to symplectic type. It means that JA is is equivalent to a symplectic structure by a B-field gauge transformation. So this is a symplectic structure. So let me just state that in a simpler way. So associated to a solution to this system, we have a pair of generalized complex structures, and there's a special case in which one of them is very simple. It's a symplectic structure. So that means that essentially it becomes off diagonal, and this just becomes a symplectic form, and this is its inverse. That's what's indicated here. Oops, sorry. And this F is a symplectic structure. Okay. It does not mean that this commutator is the product of the sum and the difference of the complex structures. And so just because I'm assuming that this thing is invertible, it does not mean that this one is as well. And so there is no a priori constraint on the rank of Q. Q could be changing rank along the manifold. It could have it could be anything. Q could be any kind of holomorphic Poisson structure in principle. So this assumption is not kind of reducing the complexity of the holomorphic Poisson structure. Okay, so in this case, in this case of symplectic type, it turns out that there's an interesting way of viewing the rest of the structure. So in this case, the pair of holomorphic Poisson structures are gauge equivalent. So this is a theorem of mine from several years ago. What I mean by that is that if we conjugate by the B-field transform determined by this symplectic structure, it takes this to this. So what I mean by this is that this, I can represent it as a generalized complex structure itself, which is of upper triangular type. This holomorphic Poisson structure is also a generalized complex structure. Okay. And the point is that they are gauge equivalent. Okay, so at this point you can forget everything that I've said until now, and this has an independent mathematical meaning. So this is a holomorphic Poisson structure. This is another one. They are not necessarily equivalent. The underlying complex manifold structures could be inequivalent. This could be, for example, something like CP one cross CP1. This one could be something like the second Herzebruch surface, which is a P1 bundle over P1, a non-trivial P1 bundle. So there is no holomorphic equivalence between these two. However, when I view them as generalized complex structures, they are gauge equivalent. This is a symmetry of T plus T star, a symmetry of the bracket, et cetera, and it takes, by conjugation, this operator to this one. So this is a more general notion of equivalence between holomorphic Poisson structures. So this gauge equivalence, this does not imply holomorphic equivalence, because of course the underlying complex manifolds could be quite different. Okay, and No, they're not. You need to include the holomorphic Poisson structure. So when you include the holomorphic Poisson structure, well, if you wait a few minutes, then I'll answer your question the best that I can. You'll get an answer, but it may not be the one you want, but I will try to answer you. So, okay. So the point is that in this case of symplectic type, we have one kind of incomplete, we have an incomplete understanding given by this picture, which is to say that the two holomorphic Poisson structures are gauge equivalent. So, maybe just to give you an example of this, okay, suppose that we take a Kähler manifold, and sigma, a holomorphic Poisson structure, okay, then and f, a real function. Okay, then I can produce a pair of gauge equivalent holomorphic Poisson structures in the following way. Take your holomorphic Poisson structure and decompose it into its real and imaginary parts. Use the imaginary part to produce the Hamiltonian vector field of this function f and integrate this to a flow. Then what we can do is flow the complex structure and the claim is that there is a gauge equivalence between the resulting pair of complex structures. The gauge equivalence is given by ddc of f, not quite. What you need to do is to take the time dependent ddc of f and average it over time t. Excuse me. Sorry. This is just the original complex structure. So this is the original complex structure on the Kähler manifold together with its holomorphic Poisson structure. This is a different one, which I obtained by just flowing I by the flow. And the claim is that there is a gauge equivalence between them given by this two form, which is not exactly ddc of this function, but rather an averaged version of that, where this is the dc operator for I. This is for phi s of I. So this is just a kind of simple example of a construction of a solution to this system. And so as a result of that, this will give an example of a symplectic type generalized Kähler structure. And notice that I just chose the holomorphic Poisson structure. I could choose it to be anything I want. So there is no a priori constraint on it. Okay. All right, so the problem with the problem with what I've described so far is that this notion of gauge equivalence is kind of happening in a completely different category. So here we have an object in the holomorphic category, similarly here, but this gauge equivalence is not in the holomorphic category. So the result that I'm going to describe is a better version of this result, which explains the true relationship between the holomorphic Poisson structures. Okay, and in order to understand the result, I need to explain to you what is a holomorphic Morita equivalent, or a symplectic Morita equivalent. Okay. So for this, I'm going to use a subject that was developed by Weinstein. So the Weinstein school of Poisson geometry, they developed over many years the following idea. So if we have a Poisson manifold, okay, what Weinstein studied was the possibility of desingularizing it in a certain sense, desingularizing it in the sense that can you find a symplectic manifold together with a map, a surjective submersion, okay, such that if I take the symplectic form and invert it, that Poisson structure maps precisely down to Q. Okay. This is called a symplectic realization. And the idea behind this is that you're encoding the complexity of this Poisson structure and all of its leaves and the singular leaves and so on. You're encoding it completely in this map, because of course the domain of the map is symplectic and so it has no local invariant. To infinity, yes, but so at this point you could just imagine that this is holomorphic and this would be holomorphic. So I'm sticking with one category. It could be to infinity or holomorphic. Most of what they focused on was the C-infinity case, but it's unchanged. What I'm about to say is no different in either case. Okay. Now, the interesting thing about these symplectic realizations is the following. So what they noticed, that if you have a symplectic realization, okay, let me draw it like this, pi going to m. If you have a symplectic realization, then there are fibers of this projection map. This map is a surjective submersion, so this is almost a fiber bundle, although the fibers don't have to be compact. Because we have a symplectic form here, I can take the tangent space to the fibers, the vertical bundle, and I can take its symplectic orthogonal. The symplectic orthogonal will produce, I'll call this the vertical bundle, and this will be the symplectic orthogonal of the vertical bundle. It doesn't have to be transverse to V. It could coincide with V at certain points. Okay. So the interesting thing about this condition of pi being a Poisson map from omega inverse to Q is that the distribution that you get from taking this symplectic orthogonal is automatically involutive and determines a foliation. Okay, and that foliation has, locally speaking, a leaf space. So let's say this is the leaf space. Not only that, it also says that the symplectic form, if I invert it, it will be invariant along these directions, and I can push it forward. It's possible to push it forward, and we get a Poisson structure. So in other words, to summarize, V is the symplectic orthogonal V is involutive, and then the quotient map is Poisson. Let's say, locally speaking, it's a manifold. Yeah, it's not. Of course, it's not automatic. It's not guaranteed to be a manifold without further assumptions. But the point is that we started with a Poisson manifold, we looked for a symplectic realization, and automatically this thing is mapping to, is determining another Poisson manifold, which is potentially different from the original. Okay. So this observation led to the notion of Morita equivalence between one Poisson manifold and another. So this is an instance of the notion of symplectic Morita equivalence. Okay, so the idea is that we have two Poisson manifolds. What you find is a symplectic manifold equipped with two surjective submersions, each of which is a Poisson map, and such that the fibers are symplectically orthogonal. So PM, PN are surjective submersive Poisson maps, such that omega takes the kernel they're symplectically orthogonal, the two fibers. This is the primary example, and so this is an equivalence relation on Poisson manifolds. And this Yes. So this will essentially provide a bimodule for the Poisson algebras on the either side. So you can take the Poisson algebra functions. This will act on the Poisson algebra functions here and similarly there, and they will commute because of this condition. So the action on the left and on the right will commute, and so it's a bimodule. The category of Poisson modules are equivalent, yes. Yes, so perhaps you are more satisfied with the answer than I thought you would be. I'm sorry? Okay, so now, the next observation that Weinstein made was that among, so, you know, I haven't said much about how one would construct such a symplectic realization. It's almost like a desingularization problem. And they have various methods for doing this. But the most important observation is that associated to any Poisson manifold, there is a canonical symplectic realization. So, which is called the Weinstein groupoid, which is there's a canonical symplectic realization, which is a Morita equivalence from MQ to itself. So the idea is that we have. We have some symplectic manifold, which is equipped with a Poisson map down to the base. Okay, so let's say I'll consider this map here. This map T has various fibers. These fibers have a symplectic orthogonal distribution. Those are in, that is involutive. It has a quotient, and the quotient is M again. So they observed, I'm sorry?
Global.
It's a global story, yes. Yeah. So the idea is that for any Poisson manifold, there should exist a symplectic manifold of twice the dimension. So the dimension of G is twice the dimension of M. Okay. It has a symplectic structure. Okay. And the reason that it's called a Weinstein groupoid is that it has a multiplication structure on it. So what that means is that each point in this symplectic manifold, there's two maps down to the base, which what we call source and target. So it has a source and it has a target. Okay. And so we can think of this element as an arrow which goes from this point to this point. And the point is that that this has the structure of a groupoid, so that if I have two elements, G1 and G2, which go in the appropriate way from source to target and from source to target, okay, then there exists a composite G1, G2, which goes from the source to the target. Okay. So there was a 15-year-long program of studying these things and figuring out under what conditions on a Poisson manifold does such a thing exist as a smooth symplectic manifold. And there's a theory by Kreinig and Fernandez which describes the obstructions to this. So there are obstructions to the smoothness of this space. It always exists as a stack, but it may not be smooth. They describe the obstructions, and I have never encountered a Poisson manifold for which the obstructions are non-zero. So they're always zero, as far as I'm concerned. Okay. So this means that there is a... and I should say that there are identity arrows. So for each point in the base, there's a special point. I'll draw the identity bisection. The identity is a map which takes each point to a special arrow that does nothing, that whose source and target are the same point that you started with. So this thing is like a group, but it has it's exactly like a Lie group. This is similar to a Lie group. but with a manifold of identity elements. Okay. All right. It's called the Weinstein symplectic groupoid. Yeah, the canonical symplectic groupoid. If the Poisson structure is zero, then this thing is the cotangent bundle, which is a groupoid because you can add the elements of any fiber. So I'll put the examples here. So if the Poisson structure, which I called Q, is zero, then this groupoid is the cotangent bundle of M, which has a zero section and which has an addition operation on the fibers. If Q is symplectic, then G... Correct, yeah. They're both the projection, yeah. I should put it like this, S and T, they agree. In the case of a symplectic structure, the groupoid is just the product with the two projection maps to M. And when you're not in this case, all hell breaks loose, except in this very nice example. If you take the dual of a Lie algebra, the dual of a Lie algebra is always Poisson. And there is a very nice Poisson manifold, the cotangent bundle of any integrating Lie group, which is equipped with two maps, the left translation and the right translation, which if we use it to pull back one forms, that one form will be pulled back to the fiber over the identity, which is indeed the dual of the Lie algebra. So this would be the groupoid in that case. Okay, so there, yeah. It's really, so if you wanted to find examples of something that is not integrable, what you would need to do is take take something like the dual of a Lie algebra, say the dual of SO3, and look at all of the coadjoint orbits. Each of the coadjoint orbits has an area, and the area increases in a very nice way. Change that function to be something like some kind of exponential growth function, and that obstructs the existence of the integrating groupoid. Okay. Say again?
Is it something
that, like, the way that they constructed this groupoid in general was to use an idea of Cattaneo and Felder using this Poisson sigma model, where this groupoid is expressed as a space of so-called Poisson paths up to homotopy. So there is a way of describing it as an infinite dimensional symplectic reduction from a phase space coming from the Poisson sigma model, but yeah, I mean, that's, yeah. That came quite a bit later compared to Weinstein's original ideas. Okay, now... Yes. So there is no mystery about how to construct this thing. You can construct it as an infinite dimensional space, moduli space, exactly as you're describing. Yeah. And that's what Krynek Fernandez did. Yeah. Okay. So, okay, very good. So the first theorem for today, which is by me and my former student, Mike Bailey, is a very a simple observation. Suppose that we have, suppose, let me just use the same notation as before. So suppose that we have two holomorphic Poisson structures, which are related by this B-field transformation. So they're gauge equivalent. Which means for us that they gave a generalized Kähler solution. So these two complex structures were participating in a generalized Kähler structure. Okay, then the theorem says the following: take the groupoid, the holomorphic symplectic groupoid of this holomorphic Poisson structure. Okay, so this is a symplectic bimodule or a symplectic Morita equivalence from I minus to itself. However, what you can do is the following. So we can deform it. So we deform in the following way. We keep the space the same, but we change this holomorphic symplectic form by adding the pullback of the B field F. Okay. So the interesting thing is that this is a new holomorphic symplectic structure, but this is the trick that you sometimes see in holomorphic symplectic geometry or hyperkähler. So when we change the complex two form, we're actually changing the underlying complex structure, right? So it determines the complex structure. It's a new holomorphic symplectic structure for a deformed complex structure on G. So we have actually changed not just, yeah, so we leave the maps alone, but we change the complex structure of G. Now, it turns out that by changing G, the complex structure, by this T star of F, it does not spoil the fact that S is a holomorphic map. So this continues to be a holomorphic map. But the interesting thing is that this map, this T map, is no longer holomorphic, but rather it is holomorphic in this sense. So the theorem says that we can take the holomorphic symplectic groupoid and deform it, and what we get is a holomorphic symplectic Morita equivalent. So we get a symplectic Morita equivalence. Okay. So this means that we can now interpret this generalized Kähler structure, or this gauge equivalence, in a purely holomorphic way. It's a purely holomorphic symplectic way. So we have holomorphic symplectic, holomorphic Poisson, and so on. Okay. So that is an important change. And so now the final result, which it'll take me a while to explain, is okay, so what I'm claiming now is that this picture is the holomorphic substructure. It is the holomorphic degrees of freedom underlying a generalized Kähler structure. So underlying the generalized Kähler structure, we saw from Hitchin that there are these two holomorphic Poisson structures. But in addition to those, there is this holomorphic symplectic manifold, which maps to both of them, implementing a Morita equivalence between them. Okay, that's part of the underlying holomorphic structure that's hidden in those equations of GK geometry. Okay. So, but it's also clear that we're not going to get a Riemannian metric out of this. This is just holomorphic data. So I cannot extract any kind of generalized Kähler metric. So the claim is that this, let me call it from this whole, this Morita equivalence is the holomorphic, I just want to summarize what I was just saying, that this is the analog of the complex structure in Kähler geometry. Okay. And it has holomorphic moduli. Okay. So the question is how to extract the metric, the real geometry, or the Riemannian geometry, because it's clear that it's not a holomorphic object, just as in the Kähler geometry. Okay. So the theorem, the main theorem for today, which is by myself and my current student, Francis Biscoff, at U of T, is that generalized Kähler geometry of symplectic type this is the version of the theorem I'm going to state today, is equivalent to a brain bisection of Z. So let me explain what that means. So we have these two foliations. Okay. And so the additional piece of information which is required to go into this picture is that we need a bisection, meaning I'll call it L. So this is a section of both P minus and P plus at the same time. Okay? And it's also a brain, which means that it must be a brain for a holomorphic, in a holomorphic symplectic manifold, it has to be a Lagrangian, essentially. So it has to be Lagrangian. Okay? But not Lagrangian for, so this holomorphic symplectic structure, what is it? It's a complex symplectic form. So it has a real and it has an imaginary part, which I'll call B and omega. Okay? So this thing has to be, you know, when we study brains in holomorphic symplectic geometry, we know from many, many papers, for example, if we look at Witten's paper on geometric quantization from a few years back, he was studying exactly this kind of scenario, and brains are brains for this, the imaginary part, not the real part. This is interpreted as a B field. So it has to be Lagrangian for omega, which means that it's not necessarily holomorphic, but rather it's just real. It's a real smooth Lagrangian. Okay. So that is the non-holomorphic piece of data. Okay. Yes. I'll get to that in a moment. So notice that omega, you can of course restrict it to L, and what you will get is B plus I omega restricted to L, and this is just B restricted to L. So you get some real two form. So this recovers the two form F, which was the additional piece of information that you had here. Okay. Another thing that this this gives. So this is number one, I suppose. So we get a two form F on the Lagrangian with real coefficients. But of course, because we have a bisection, this determines a smooth map from this manifold to this one, which normally we would not have had. So in other words, for each point, I can just look at the fiber above that point. That intersects the bisection at a unique point. I stop there, and then I follow the other projection down. So this would be phi of x, which depends on this Lagrangian. So this determines a smooth map, a diffeomorphism from to n, like that. Okay, and then it is clear that that you'll have enough information. So now you have the two complex structures, which originally are just two holomorphic Poisson manifolds. They're totally separate. They could be non-isomorphic, whatever. But because of the existence of this real Lagrangian, they become diffeomorphic. That means I put them on the same smooth manifold, which is necessary for generalized scalar geometry. But furthermore, I need this B field, which relates them. And that's provided by the real part of the holomorphic symplectic form on here. Okay, so what I'd like to do in the remaining time, I just want to describe how, okay, so I'm going to describe this in detail, but basically once you see this picture, it's clear why there should be a generalized Cayley potential, because the degree of freedom, which is the only degree of freedom beyond the holomorphic stuff, is this Lagrangian. And we know that deforming a Lagrangian is basically one scalar degree of freedom. And that's the reason. So I'll try to describe that in a bit more detail. Okay, so let's see. Okay, I'll say two things. So first is, here's a question, how to extract the metric G. Okay, it's kind of interesting how it happens. So imagine that we have this Lagrangian brain, okay, and we have a point on this brain, and let's suppose that I wanted to describe the Riemannian metric at this point. Say I was trying to describe the Riemannian metric at a point X, which is identified with a point here and with a point there. Okay, so there is no metric on the ambient space. The ambient space is a holomorphic symplectic structure. Nevertheless, I should be able to get a real symmetric tensor on the tangent space to L. So the way that you do it is, well, I wish that I had a better description than the one I'm about to give you, but this is what I can come up with. So we have the fibers of one of the foliations and the other fibers. They give you two symplectically orthogonal spaces at this point. So these are symplectic orthogonal of each other. And you also have the tangent space to L. So we have one Lagrangian subspace of the tangent space, and we have a pair of transverse symplectically orthogonal subspaces. It turns out that you can take the average between these two. That makes has invariant sense to it. We can take the average, and this describes a Lagrangian. So this, I'll call this TL, and this will be T star L. So it tells us that the tangent space of this big holomorphic symplectic manifold restricted to L actually decomposes as TL plus T star L. And because of this fact, this is just a normal bundle, which since this is Lagrangian, right, the normal bundle is always identified with the cotangent bundle. It's just that we have a specified choice of normal bundle, which is a bit unusual. But anyway, that's what we get from the geometry. And this sum of bundles has two natural inner products on it. It has a symmetric one and a skew symmetric one. The symmetric one, you know, if I have x plus c, this would be c1 of x2 plus c2 of x1. This would be c1 of x2 minus c2 of x1. So there's a natural symmetric and skew symmetric inner product on this bundle. And what I can do is notice that the tangent space to L is not a complex subspace, because L is not a holomorphic subbundle. L is not a holomorphic Lagrangian. Remember, it's the real piece of data, so it fails to be holomorphic. I can apply the complex structure to the tangent space, and I get yet another Lagrangian subspace. So if I take this positive definite inner product and restrict it to I times TL, what I get is the metric. If I take the negative definite and restrict it to I of TL, I get the B field whose derivative is the 3 form. So the whole geometry can be extracted just by looking at how this Lagrangian subspace is sitting inside the holomorphic symplectic manifold. So it's kind of, there are certain things which are kind of reminiscent of twister theory, but I still don't really have a good understanding of why this Lagrangian gets an induced metric on it. But anyway, that's the procedure. Okay. So anyway, all of this explanation of how the geometry emerges from the positioning of this Lagrangian, that's part of the theorem with Francis. It kind of gives a detailed description of how the geometry emerges from this Lagrangian, this brain bisection. Okay. So the last thing I want to mention is about the title. I'm losing chalk. Okay, so the last piece is the Kähler potential itself. The generalized Kähler potential. And how do we interpret it? So this is quite interesting in its own right. So we have to, again, this will be a scalar function, a real scalar function. It's local, but the important thing is that it's local in Z, right? So without this holomorphic symplectic space, it would be impossible to understand this generalized Kähler potential. So let me again explain it in a picture. So we have this Lagrangian. So this is a real Lagrangian. This is the real Lagrangian brain. Okay. So in order to see, in order to describe this thing in terms of a real function, I'm going to do the following. I'm going to pick a holomorphic. I'm going to pick Darboux coordinates. I'll just denote it in this way. So we choose holomorphic Darboux coordinates. And let's say this is the Q and this is the P of the holomorphic Darboux coordinate. Okay? So if we choose holomorphic Darboux coordinates, then L is the graph. See, L is now, I can think of these Darboux coordinates as the holomorphic tangent bundle of the Q space. Right? This is a patch which is identified with the holomorphic cotangent bundle of the Q variables. And this is a section of that that holomorphic tangent bundle. So L is the graph of a 1-0 form eta. Okay. And the important thing about this thing is that since the holomorphic symplectic structure restricts to L to give this F, this implies that D of eta is real. Because the derivative of eta is measuring exactly this restriction of the holomorphic symplectic structure to L. And if that's the case, then that means that the imaginary part of eta is closed. And so that means the imaginary part of eta is D of a function, which is unique up to constant. I'll call that function K, because K, K of Q, Q bar, this is the generalized Kähler potential, and it's unique up to constant, actually. So it's a version of the usual idea that a Lagrangian can be expressed as the derivative as the graph of the derivative of a one form in the cotangent bundle. You have to modify that concept in the holomorphic case. So we have a holomorphic symplectic manifold, or the holomorphic cotangent bundle. We have a non-holomorphic section, but it's still described by a real function. Okay. So that's basically what I wanted to explain. So this means that in this chart on Z, we can recover all geometric structures from this K. But of course, just as in the Kähler case, we need to have the holomorphic background geometry determined. We need to have this Darboux chart, which means we need this holomorphic symplectic structure. If we have the holomorphic symplectic structure on this manifold, which is equipped with these maps down to the holomorphic Poisson structures, then this function is enough. And so we looked back through all of the literature since that time, where people were able to find a generalized Kähler potential in certain very special cases, and this agrees with those computations. But the interesting thing is that this extends the notion of potential to the general case. So what remains is to drop the condition that one of the generalized complex structures is of symplectic type. But that's for another day. Thanks for your attention.
You have this statement about complex moduli in my scale of life. Is there a finite dimension?
So if you were, what I think is that the place where you'll, so the holomorphic substructure, this holomorphic symplectic Morita equivalence, that thing should have a finite dimensional space of deformations. But of course, the Lagrangian, the Z is not compact. It's not compact, but it is constrained. I mean, it is heavily constrained. It's by these foliations, yeah. And so there is a candidate Dalbeau group, which is a Dalbeau group on the base, which describes its deformations. So I have not worked out the deformation theory of that thing, but I strongly believe that it is finite dimensional for that part of the geometry. Then of course there's this real Lagrangian. Yes, I can see a way of doing that, but like I said, it hasn't been. Yeah, it's a good idea, but I haven't pursued it. Basically, there's all this work currently about trying to describe deformations of generalized Kähler, and it's a very difficult subject because they have an incomplete understanding of the holomorphic part of the geometry. That's the reason why these groups have so many difficulties. Let's stay the same. What's certain is that if you want this Morita equivalence, I'm not sure. I mean, actually, you should be able to allow any, you know, your deformations of Poisson structure. Those would be allowed on either side. Right. Yeah, so the point is that the holomorphic structure does not impose that the two complex structures, that the two holomorphic Poisson manifolds are diffeomorphic or even the same dimension. The holomorphic structure is just this Morita equivalence between two holomorphic Poisson structures. It doesn't know anything about the fact that they should exist on the same smooth manifold. So in order to enforce that, you need this bisection because that's what gives you the map. Yeah, in generalized Kähler geometry, they are of course happening on the same space.
You sort of argue the potential.
Yeah.
As the deformation theory of Lagrangian.
Yes.
Could be governed by a.
By a function, yes.
We need to support it not only as Lagrangian but also.
Oh yes, but the bisection condition is an open condition. It's a generic condition. If you deform it, it'll remain transverse to the SNT fibers.
Some natural moduli spaces
which carry generalized Kähler structure.
And
yeah, I mean, so one way that, well, okay, I mean, there are some, there's various papers identifying generalized Kähler structures on instanton moduli spaces and such, but you know, one natural way that you can produce Morita equivalent but non-isomorphic Poisson manifolds, is through these moduli space constructions. Like, for example, if you consider, you know, flat connections on a surface, and then you do some kind of isomonodromic deformation, this produces families of Poisson varieties. And whenever you can put a Poisson variety into a family which satisfies a certain condition on the total space, it turns out that it will imply that that any two members of the family are Morita equivalent, even though they're non-isomorphic. So there is a kind of there are candidates for finding these Morita equivalences, but then one would have to find these brains sitting inside those equivalences. So yeah, I mean, it would be interesting to try to cook up new examples by using these moduli constructions.
What if you cross forward?
Well, if the diffeomorphism type changes, then we cannot hope to have this L, and so you can't expect. Yeah, I mean, the challenge is that on a generalized Kähler manifold. So there's a big project now of trying to construct examples of generalized Kähler manifolds for threefolds and in higher dimension. And so one place to look would be in with these moduli constructions, but you're definitely forced. They have to be diffeomorphic. Yeah. Yeah. I think Davide is falling asleep, so he can't stop.
Thanks.
Okay, thanks. Yeah.